Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome one and all to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Trust you had a great weekend. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. And Jim, you have many clever headlines in the Morning Jolt, but I don't know that I've ever enjoyed one more than I saw today with the two sentences, Kim Jong-il, no, Kim Jong-dead. The good martini today is, as you pointed out also in the Morning Jolt today, 2012 will be a rebuilding year for evil, with Kim Jong-il being the latest dictator to fall. 69 years old. We had known for a while he was in ill health. There was a reported stroke a couple of years ago. Of course, the official North Korean explanation is that he's just really working very, very hard, and it just gave out. Apparently, it was a heart attack. The big question, of course, is will his son be as crazy as he is, or perhaps even worse, or will we finally make a little bit of progress in North Korea? But the good news is that after 17 years of sheer insanity, Kim Jong-il is off the scene.
The insane leader is dead. Long live the new insane leader. It's one of those things where in the big picture, things in North Korea may not change all that dramatically. This morning, there's already a report of them conducting a missile test. So I guess that's the traditional way they greet the departure of a leader, shooting off. It's kind of like fireworks. You know, they shoot their own missiles over there. Having said that, Kim Jong-il was an evil, evil man responsible for unbelievable level of suffering for just year after year after year. And so it is fantastic that he has now assumed room temperature. And again, we don't know that things on the Korean Peninsula will get that much safer or that much better. But you know, you knew with Kim Jong-il it was never going to get any better. And now maybe there's that tiny, tiny fraction of an opportunity that maybe North Koreans will recognize how far behind they have fallen, how much they have suffered, and how much needless waste of human life and human potential has been there. Having said that, it's North Korea. Never get your hopes up too high, and just hopefully the circumstance will not get too explosive. Apparently, to some analysts, this was not necessarily the nightmare scenario, but this was the scenario where it was most likely to for things to get chaotic. So it's a good martini. Certainly, this is a bad man, and every time a bad man dies, we can drink heartily to that. Let's just keep our fingers crossed that we don't end up having any escalation of tensions as a result of all this.
Yeah, hopefully so. I guess it's a good martini with a chaser of pragmatism on this one. But yeah, you're right, Jim. This is a guy who not only rattled the saber needlessly on the nuclear program, but as you pointed out, needlessly making his own people suffer mass starvation in order to build up the military, and exchanging potentially those weapons with terrorists being one of the major potential areas of funding for his country. Just so backwards, so repressive in rights of all kinds, the most closed society on earth. And I hope the people have some inkling there of just how evil he was. But my guess is they just don't, because dissent of any kind is just simply not permitted there. So on a day that we also mourn the passing of a great champion of liberty, Václav Havel, watching Kim Jong-il go is an impressive contrast in the opposite direction, I think. On to martini number two now, and back to stateside domestic politics. And Newt Gingrich has been the front runner in the Republican presidential race for the last, I guess, week or two, and that means he's going to be taking on some heat. One of the things he's talking about now, Jim, just seems to be completely self-inflicted. I don't know if it's because of his huge ego or because he thinks it's going to play well with the base, particularly in Iowa, or what, but this idea that he first talked about really at length, I think, in the public realm at the debate in Sioux City on Thursday night, but he's talked about it and elaborated on it greatly since then, is this idea that judges that he doesn't like, or courts that he doesn't like, if he's president, he'll just abolish it. Judges will have to testify before Congress to explain their decisions. He might just decide to get rid of judges. For a guy who's been a history professor, I would hope at some point he covered the Constitution and its crafting and perhaps the separation of powers, because if this guy wins the nomination, this is going to be huge fodder for Obama, which is horrible. I can just see a nightmare scenario coming out on this, because this just doesn't make a lot of sense. And even most conservatives, I think, are cringing at this.
Greg, you just don't get it because you're a rhino. You know that, Greg? In the eyes of Gingrich, this is the kind of bold. He had said the traditional argument of conservatives to judicial activism is to appoint better judges. And he says he thinks that's not sufficient. And I suppose on some gut level, I can understand that sense of frustration. And he cites some examples that make this seem quite compelling. I mean, he cites a judge who said he would, you know, jail anyone who tried to use the word God in a high school graduation ceremony. So, look, we have activist judges. We have runaway judges. We have people who have earned those criticisms of them as being dictators in robes. However, basically the philosophy of Newt in this is that any two branches of government can overrule the other one. And so his idea is that as president, he could, you know, eliminate courts and you know, remove judges. Alternatively, judges could be called before Congress and have to be forced to defend their decisions under questioning from under members of Congress. Now, again, as appealing as this may feel in one's gut when one sees a judge acting kind of, you know, just unhinged, there's something kind of troubling about this because, you know, the way I was taught about the Constitution, the way I think a lot of people would see this is that, look, sometimes what is popular is not always right, and sometimes it is potentially very problematic. And so, you know, popular and constitutional are not synonyms. So the whole idea of the Supreme Court kind of having the last word in these sorts of things is that somebody's job has to be to protect the Constitution. Somebody's job has got to be, no matter if, you know, public sentiment is overwhelmingly in one direction, a large enough vote cannot undo the Constitution unless there's a constitutional amendment. And so the job of the, you know, Supreme Court is protect those individual liberties, protect the Constitution as it is meant to be. By the way, this is the way, you know, the strict constructionists see this. Their role is to be the backstop against these sorts of things. What Newt is proposing would basically say that in some future, you know, circumstance in which liberal Democrats had a majority on the House and Senate and the White House, that they could overrule the Supreme Court.
Right.
That if the Supreme Court said Obamacare, the individual mandate is unconstitutional, the Congress and the president could say, we don't care, and just continue to operate. And so it is a very drastic change in the way we're used to doing things. Right now, if Roberts and, you know, four justices say Obamacare is unconstitutional because the individual mandate, it's back to the drawing board, and that the, you know, Congress and the president would have to, you know, enact some sort of reform that would not run afoul of that ruling. Under this, they could ignore them if they have a large enough majority. I mean, this is a way to turn this into a more small D democratic country. But I got to tell you, you know, we've had times. I know there are going to be times I'm in the minority, and I'd much rather have a Supreme Court in there to interpret things through the prism of the Constitution and not through the prism of public opinion. You know, so I see this at the very best a double-edged sword. On the other hand, a potential to really take away kind of the last lines of defense that traditional conservatives have in this world. I'm sure there'll be some people who will like it, but I would just say look beyond the unhinged judge and just think about what a future Speaker Pelosi would do to a Chief Justice John Roberts under something like this. If you don't see trouble from this, I think you're just not thinking that hardly about it.
Yeah, I think Megyn Kelly brought it right up there in the debate. This may sound good for conservatives if conservatives wield the power, but if President Obama gets reelected with the Democratic Congress, like you mentioned, there'd be conservative courts who could conceivably be abolished. So for me, it's kind of like the old idea of the no filibuster on the judicial nominees. It sounds really, really good until the other party gets to make the rules and then goes the other way. Be very careful what you wish for, because at some point you will be out of power. On to martini number three now. And Jim, conventional wisdom doesn't do very well sometimes, and it's not doing very well in Iowa right now, because across the board after the last debate, it seemed like the conclusion of everybody was, you know, Gingrich defended himself pretty well. People maybe scored a couple points on Freddie Mac. For the most part, nobody hurt themselves. But Ron Paul was crazy on Iran and the foreign policy thing, and he basically ruined himself. Oh, really? Well, according to public policy polling, Ron Paul now leads in Iowa, thank you very much, with 23% of the vote. Romney at 20, Gingrich slipping to 14, Santorum, Bachman, and Perry at 10%, Huntsman at 4. Jim, obviously this is a poll that looks a lot different from others, so we'll see in the next week or so whether this is real or an aberration. But what's pretty clear is that Ron Paul is very competitive in Iowa. He probably has the most passionate following there in terms of intensity of his followers. And a lot of people seem to believe he's got the best organization there. That's a pretty good combination in an Iowa caucus.
Yeah, I was hearing somebody on Twitter today making the observation that they think, you know, the organization can give you or can take away about 4 or 5 points in the Iowa caucuses from a poll. It's not like a primary. It's not you can vote any day you want. You got to show up at a particular place at a particular time and you know, then turn around and persuade your neighbors. And so it's kind of a little bit of public debate going on with this. He feels that this will help Ron Paul by a couple of points and probably hurt Gingrich by a couple of points. Ron Paul has kind of been creeping up there, and I think he did third place in the Ames straw poll. We really shouldn't be surprised by that. We really shouldn't be surprised by his supporters being motivated and driven and having their stuff together. I mean, no matter how much we may disagree with some of them, let's face it, these folks are motivated and they do not, you know, sit on their couches and casually support their man. So, in a way, as somebody who's kind of frustrated by the role Iowa plays in this, I think Ron Paul winning Iowa is fantastic. I'm very happy to let him have that one. I think Ron Paul fans deserve one night to celebrate and high five each other. And, you know, caucuses are like I said, are their bread and butter. So in a way, there's a certain amount of congratulations to them if this comes to pass. Having said that, this has been such a year of rapid change. It feels like we should have like five more lead changes between now and caucus night on the 3rd of January. So we'll see what happens. Let's face it, a Ron Paul caucus victory is now not even unthinkable. Maybe even it's probable at this point. So if anybody thought this would be a coronation, this is not the year for a Republican coronation, for Romney or for Gingrich or for anybody.
Apparently not. Here's my question for you, Jim. If Ron Paul does win the Iowa caucuses on January 3rd, what's the over-under on John Bolton getting in the race on January 4th?
Well, here's the irony of, and this is, I guess you could say, a fail-safe built into the Republican primary process. So as much as, you know, I don't, you know, you have Iowa and then you have New Hampshire. And New Hampshire and Iowa are pretty, you know, they're both rural states, but politically and culturally, they're a little bit different.
Right.
And as I've said, the purpose of New Hampshire is to refute Iowa. I don't know if people in New Hampshire personally hate Iowans, but they almost never select the same person. It's only when there's an incumbent president do they do so. So whoever won Iowa, you're almost destined to lose New Hampshire. And so in a way, I kind of joke the best way to win New Hampshire is to lose Iowa. And, you know, Ron Paul still has his level of support somewhere in New Hampshire, but it's not really his best state. For Ron Paul, it might be interesting to say, I think he might just, you know, skip straight to you'd think that he being semi-libertarianish and, you know, New Hampshire having a libertarian streak, that it might mesh well. But if Ron Paul were to win Iowa, part of me wouldn't be surprised to see him jump to South Carolina and see how he could do there. Look, Ron Paul would make this a very interesting race. And, you know, this is a race that's already dripping with interest right now.
Yeah, there's certainly no lack of drama or upheaval or turmoil and lead changes, as you mentioned before. So we'll keep watching. And, yeah, that seems still like an eternity, 2 weeks away from the Iowa caucuses. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.